Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. People that have heard the show before know that they can find my most recent column for Westchester Guardian at westchesterguardian.com. The list of upcoming shows is at my site, www.johnmack13.com, and that's JohnMack13. And all of the previous 90 shows are there for listening. My guest next week is college basketball player, high school teacher, motel co-owner, and senior Olympics competitor in 3-on-3 basketball, Steve Lawrence. And now to this show. The 91st in the series, callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. I do hold all the on-air callers and to near the conclusion of my interview. My guest tonight is writer Andrew Gross, author and co-author of 13 Mysteries. I first met Andy through his writing when he co-authored books with the well-known James Patterson, later through his own solo work, and finally through our Facebook connection. His most recent book, One Mile Under, which brings back detective hero Ty Hawk, was released by William Morrow Publishing early this year. It turns out that Andy has a tight schedule that's been made tighter by the technical.
You got me for about 45 minutes. So.
I promise I'll try to get him out of here.
Okay.
Good evening, Andy. So welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you very much, John.
Nice to be in here
at last. So, yes, go ahead.
Let's start at the beginning. Where exactly did you grow up and go to early school?
Where did I grow up and go to?
To early school, yeah.
Oh, I'm a native New Yorker. I grew up in Manhattan. Went to the same school for 14 years, which was called Barnard School for Boys, which actually merged with Horace Mann in Riverdale the year that I graduated. So I kind of say that I graduated from Horace Mann, but it was really Barnard. And I haven't gotten very far in all these years. I gotten about 25 miles north in Westchester. I guess after that, I went on to college in Vermont at Middlebury College, and then got an MBA in Columbia. And for the first 20 years of my professional life, I was in various forms of the apparel business, mostly the active sportswear apparel business, and really had not thought much about this kind of career.
What were your earliest aspirations? I know that you were born into a family business, but do you have any writing yearnings from youth, or what did you write?
Yeah, I did. I actually got into college because I was a published poet in high school. I guess it overcame a few C's and D's in the sciences and math disciplines and got me into a school that was kind of above my academic pay grade at that point. So, and then both in high school and even in college, I edited the literary magazines. I did it at Middlebury as a sophomore and junior. So as an undergraduate, it was kind of a rare thing. So, you know, I really thought that I had an interest in not really in fiction writing, but I still have gaps in my let's say mystery reading but I'm fairly well grounded in most of the classics, both in English literature and various other literatures, and I actually never really thought that I'd be writing commercial fiction as I have for the amount of time that I have. And I after a couple of sort of aborted entrepreneurial attempts at things. I had a restaurant in Colorado and one or two other things. I ended up working for, as you say, a family business. It was a big company. It was called Leslie Fay, and it was a diversified New York Stock Exchange, mostly women's apparel company. And for several years, many years, I sort of rose in that environment and really wasn't thinking about too much more other than doing the best job I could managing the parts of the company that I did and, you know, just getting the job done as well as I could. So anyway, you know, that was, while I may have harbored aspirations at some point, once I got out of Columbia for an MBA, I just really just dedicated myself to being a type A guy, and I took on some fairly complicated projects and also geographically complicated for 6 years. And one of the things I was doing, it was the head ski and tennis wear. My desk was in Maryland and my home was in Mamaroneck and in Purchase. We had moved somewhere in that period and used to go down by plane in the morning and come back by plane. My kids were young. Or I would stay down there the week. So some of it was pretty daunting. I did that for 6 years. So
I know that you left the family business to go out in another business, and it seemed to crash in the end. Was that the final straw to make you pursue writing?
Well, it didn't really crash. I did get fired, but the business didn't crash. But I left Leslie Fay and I started doing these turnarounds in the active sportswear business. And one or two turned around and one or two didn't. So the last thing I was in was the Canadian ski and golfwear company and public company, but it just sort of in the 2 years I was there, it didn't respond the way that I had, you know, strategized it would. And at some point, we all just thought it was better if I didn't manage the company anymore, although I was a minority partner in the company, and just got on the sidelines and just said to my wife, I ain't going to do these anymore. I've done three of these now in the last 7 years, so a little over 2 years per. And I just left a lot of blood on the field, and I said that I was done. And so she said to me, so what are we going to do? You know, we had three kids in private school up here and actually in Greenwich and you know, living a certain life in Westchester. And I'm sure people listening know, you know, it's an expensive place to live, obviously, I she just sort of said, what are we doing? What's next? And I know I stunned her by saying, basically, I want to write a novel, which I guess over some time I'd been noodling out a storyline for a political conspiracy novel. Of course, for most people who are living in that kind of world and don't have screw-you money for the rest of their lives, announcing that they were going to write a novel is tantamount to, bringing the family to the edge of disaster. And
you made a serious commitment. You went off to the University of Iowa's writer's school, didn't you?
I did, but it was only just for, you know, a 3-week stint. I didn't get a degree. I wasn't a matriculated student there. But I did it after a certain point, and my goal in doing it was I sort of convinced my wife that I wouldn't do anything that was completely promiscuous and irresponsible, but I wanted a year. And, you know, we could afford the year, and I felt I deserved the year. And my wife was a yoga teacher at that point for 10 years, and self-actualization was really high on her list of priorities. So I knew that I had that sale made before she even answered me. She was delighted for me to do something that I felt so inspired to do. And so I had this idea. And the Iowa came in as well as the new school because I wanted to make sure. It wasn't so much that I was trying to learn how to write, although I'm sure a lot of stuff did rub off on me, but I was really trying to gauge myself and audit myself to see if I couldn't feel that I was at the top of a group of 12 aspiring writers, who was I to drag my family through the process and pretend that I could get myself published? And for whatever reason, I guess I had enough encouragement.
And, you did have a rocky start, but so did the later fairly successful Stephen King and James Patterson. Tell us about your early submissions and rejections and what it did to your psyche.
Well, you know, there's no question that anyone starting out in this game has to have a pretty thick skin and has to be prepared for a variety of rejections, some of which, of course, just trying to find, well, you know, the first rejections are just when you submit stuff that you think is shiningly brilliant and people basically tell you that it's a bunch of dog crap, you know. I didn't have that much of that, but, you know, some of it is just literally the artistic rejection. And then, of course, once you assemble that dog stuff into something that credibly resembles a novel and you think you have something and you give it out to your handful of early readers, whoever they are, whoever you can find, and they all tell you that, you know, this is fantastic, and then you start to try to get yourself an agent, you've got to be prepared for that level of rejection, because I think it took me 25 letters. I did have some interest, you know, along the way. I had a few people who were interested enough to you know, sample the goods and, you know, read 50 pages or read the whole book. And sometimes I had generous comments, and other times I just had flat rejections. And, you know, after 25 or 30 rejections, you know, the most daunting thing is to try to find a credible agent that wants to take the ride with you. And I did, you know, as a matter of fact, ironically, after all these rejections, I found two agents and in the same week. So I got to reject one after being rejected myself so many times.
And, I think that Stephen King has 28 rejections. But then you're in the right place at the right time. Tell us the story about what happened with your year.
Well, I had this book called Hydra, which is still part of my email, personal email. You know, like I said, it was sort of a political conspiracy novel that leads through the right wing. And at that time, in the mid-90s, it was like 95 or 96, was really about the Texas concealed gun law, which, you know, I guess I thought, you know, let it so, you know, it basically sort of wove through this conspiracy thing in the NRA. And in any case, I then, after finding this agent, sent it out to, I don't know how many they sent it out to. I think then there were about 20 to 22 publishers. Today, that list is about a third. With a lot of expectation and being led up that it was, you know, going to, you know, go somewhere, I ended up getting 22 rejection letters or whatever. I don't remember how many it was at this point, but everybody rejected it. And I was crestfallen. And it, sort of as I joke a little bit, I was literally sitting in my den where I am now still trying to figure out what cliff I was going to drive our SUV off of, because, you know, my trajectory 3 years back had been one that was just going upwards. And here I had dragged my family to catastrophe, and now I didn't have a hole to piss in, I guess, you know, and literally as I was sitting there sort of, you know, feeling sorry for myself, I got a call, and the call said, can you take a call from James Patterson? And I always joke that I would take a call from my gate guard if he had something good to say about Hydra. So, you know, getting on the phone, I go, yeah, of course, I can do that, you know, and shortly after he called me back and basically said, you know, after a couple of pleasantries, you've got the goods. And I went, huh? You know, like he goes, I read your book. I said, what do you mean you read my book? Well, unbeknownst to me, it was given to him by the president of Warner Publishing, which was his publisher at the time. Little Brown, and it was part of it, and with five words on the manuscript, this guy does women well, which I assume he meant, she meant that I wrote women well, And he needed someone who did women well, because in my unpublished, you know, rejected storyline, there was a very heroic kind of everyday gal who provides the central acts of heroism of the book and very strong figure. They liked it. He read it. He liked it. He calls me up and basically says, you got the goods. Let's, you know, let's meet and talk. So we met in the central diner in White Plains. And this is a little before James Patterson had the sort of deified figure that he has now, where he's had more number ones than anybody in history. As a matter of fact, you know, I think the first book I did with him was his first number one hardcover. But in any case, we met, we talked, we sort of hit it off. He threw ideas at me for about four women, these four crime fighters that had not been set yet. And geographically, I like them. I didn't even have a plan B. I was going to like them whether I didn't like the idea. And so we literally, within a couple of weeks, we were working in concert. So, you know, sort of a fortuitous story that helped get me inside the circle that I had previously been blocked from being inside.
The great advantage of a collaboration with such a well-known writer, even though he wasn't as well-known then, is Patterson is instant sales. But it seems difficult to me, but I've never done a collaboration, to write in this fashion. Is it difficult?
Well, like anything, it's sort of an acquired skill. And I think he would have said the first go-around was difficult. I was kind of on cloud nine, and I'm by nature sort of a headstrong person, and we did sometimes, you know, I mean, the real thing is to write in someone's voice. I mean, that is the real challenge. And, it, you know, until you learn that, and over time, of course, I learned it, I think, you know, intimately, you know, it's a little bit of a struggle because, you know, my natural writing style, especially at that point, was a lot denser than a Patterson book. Although, you know, we got there. Now, what's interesting is after the first book was published, it went to number one, and everybody at Little Brown was all excited, and they had me in there and basically said this was the most seamless collaboration that they'd ever experienced as a publisher. How did you guys pull it off? So the end result was pretty solid, even if there were moments of rockiness on that first book. But obviously it was good enough that Jim sort of said, how'd you like to do another one, you know? And we did another one. So we ended up doing a whole bunch of them. And clearly, you know, clearly the learning curve is it gets smoother, not more difficult. So, you know, no, I liked working with Patterson. I like him personally. He's not the easiest person in the world, I suppose, but you know, I'm a little angular in my own personality, so we fit pretty smoothly together. We both had a business background. We weren't sort of faint of heart artistically, you know. We really just wanted to create something that was going to sell and was going to please his customers. And
saw him in high school, and he still sees him. You seem to have an ongoing franchise with the collaboration. What made you withdraw from it?
Well, you know, first of all, I really thought I'd really write one book with him, and then, you know, my vision was that he would in some way team me up for me to do my own stuff. And it was fairly lucrative. We sold a bunch to television and in the early books, and you know, I earned out a lot of bonuses, and so for me it became a very smooth thing. But in my own way, I always wanted to write my own book, so I just, you know, after I'd finished one, he was submitting another project idea to me, and I was taking it. But at some point I did, you know, actually I went to a dinner party in Purchase, and this is sort of, you know, 7 years into our collaborations with a lot of books behind us. And we met this really, I don't know how interesting this is to people, but we met this sort of really icky couple at this party, at the dinner party, who arrived in their own his and her Ferraris with vanity plates and, you know, she was just dripping in all of these big stones, and they were talking about all this Relais Chateau travel that they'd been doing because their kids were out of the house now. And when my wife and I got back in our car and left to go home, I sort of went like, you know, I don't ever want to see those people again. And you know, she goes, well, I didn't think the guy was so bad. And then about a month down the line, I'm having breakfast in our house, and I opened the New York Times, and there right below the fold was this same very guy, and he's been arrested by the New York Times for money laundering. And so I start prancing around going, I told you he was a schmuck. I told you, you know. And then gradually something actually hits me. And what hits me is that it's sort of a classic Westchester, Fairfield County story. Here's a guy that's totally successful, that's bigger than life. He, you know, he's in all the right clubs. He's, you know, known in restaurants. He's big philanthropically. You know, to his family, he's the patriarchal figure. His kids revere him. And now it's proven, it comes out that his entire life has been a sham, and basically his money has come from laundering jewelry to the Colombian crime families. And I what hit me really was, I had a daughter who was a teenager at that point, and I said, what if that was me? And what if that was Kristen? And how would my daughter ever look at me again, the person she admires most in the world, if it turned out that everything she grew up and believed in was turned out to be a lie? And this became a very compelling thing to me, and so I started to map out this storyline in a very detailed outline, which I learned from Patterson, because he taught me to outline extensively up front before we put pen to page, so to speak. So
your characters don't take the book wherever they go. You have the ending planned before you start?
Well, sometimes the answer is I'm working off an outline now. I've actually sold two outlines, my first book and my last book. As you write any book, there's things that happen organically that can move the storyline in a certain way. But I like to sort of have my arms wrapped around a story. We're talking very plot intensive stories. So, you know, I don't want to lead myself down. I don't know if you can hear dogs barking in the background, but it seems like they're all climbing up to my office where I am now. I just like to have my control of a storyline. And yeah, I think it's a good thing to have an endpoint that you want to take it. I've sort of relaxed that a little bit over time, and maybe I'll outline the first half of a book now. But yeah, I guess I do it. And the truth is, I really find that upfront work in terms of plotting is the best work that I probably can do on the book ever in the process of writing it. It just, for whatever reason, it's amazing how, you know, it's at least the way that my mind works when I'm sort of thinking out a story. And so I had this outline, and I of a book called The Blue Zone, I named it, and basically that was, you know, my character in the book ends up after they've been exposed for being not money launderers. Well, they are money launderers, but it really had to do with gold. They end up in the witness protection program, and the Blue Zone was one aspect of the witness protection program. And I had this detailed outline. It was probably 80 pages long, 70 pages, single spaced, maybe 100 chapters. I didn't really have an agent when I worked with Patterson, but I knew the agent I wanted. And literally within 2 minutes after faxing him a letter sort of stating what I'd been up to the last six books and all these number one sellers behind me, you know, he calls me back, and a couple of days later, or actually it was the next day, I bring this outline into him and figure the guy will read a page or two and say, well, thanks, let me sit with it and we'll get back to you. And he literally reads the whole thing. It took about 45, 50 minutes. And I'm just sitting in his office looking at all the impressive people that he's representing and, you know, sort of twiddling my thumbs while he's reading in front of me. And he finishes, and I said, is there any chance this is sellable? And he goes, oh, I think we can sell it. And a week later, I had five publishers bidding on the outline. So, you know, it's how I started, you know, using all of my acumen from business school that I learned, I decided to go with the one who paid the most money. So
the story that you were talking about, there was an article, there was something in one of the papers today, it was either the News or the Post, some young lady saying that my father, the con man, lost all the money, and she was in some place out in the West Coast on vacation, and she got this email from her mother: "You have to get a job, sell everything now, it's all over." And apparently, everything they own was taken away. So,
well, there you go.
Really,
I mean, it's a compelling story, but the human side of that story isn't what you just said. The human side is the detritus that a family is left with, where you know, not just in terms of the money, but in terms of the shame or in terms of the sense of betrayal, which is what I tapped into. So I don't know. That's how I started. The book went to, you know, high on the bestseller list. It got sold to about 25 countries. And, you know, I went with HarperCollins, and all of a sudden they were offering me a lot of books. They started out offering me three. Then they decided, how'd you like to stay for six more before I wrote one book? Before my paperback even came out. So I ended up doing nine books with HarperCollins, and most of them have hit the Times list.
There's been nine since the end of the collaboration, and four have involved the detective,
yes.
Ty Hawk.
Yes.
You introduce him the next year in the Dark Tide, and you followed up in two more books sent at him. Can you tell us about the character and his development?
Yeah, Ty is kind of a white knight who starts out in these four books as the head of violent crimes in Greenwich, Connecticut. I wanted to write books that sort of took place in a suburban environment in the orbit of New York. So, you know, money, wealth, greed, and my heroes and my bad guys were all sort of people who may have the mom could be a soccer mom and she's instantly recognizable. The dad could be a hedge fund manager, and maybe he's got one foot running the sidelines, rooting his kids on, and the other foot into something a little more nefarious. But Ty is a Greenwich cop who carries a weight of tragedy around because he had some responsibility in the death of one of his own children, and which cost him his marriage and put him through a very dark period at a certain point. And he's moved from New York up to Greenwich, and he's really kind of a white knight. And I really sort of build his character off the Arthurian legends of the cycle of a hero. And he's the kind of person that you'd want in your foxhole with it. He's courageous. He has a clear sense of right and wrong, and he's prepared to put everything up to follow through these stories, usually at the behest of a woman, as it turns out, who step in over their head into something. He's a good guy, and at the same time, he's self-deprecating. He's got humor. He's got warmth. I had him in three books originally, and my publisher, for whatever reason, I'm not sure it was the wisest decision, but decided that that what they wanted me to do was to write these standalones of people that over their head, really, you know, very likable sort of suburban everyday heroes, doctors, lawyers, you know, a housewife, etc., you know, who through maybe a fault of their own, through a mistake that they make, or just through fate, end up stepping into the wrong place at the wrong time and get in over their heads very quickly and then can't get themselves out. And so I wrote three of these books, it's literally been five books that I've written before I was able to get back to Ty, which is the book that I have out now, which is called One Mile Under. People seem to love Ty. I mean, I've gotten a gazillion requests to bring him back. And certainly anyone who lives in the Westchester, Fairfield County area would normally recognize a lot of the places that the books take place. But this most recent book, I brought the character back that, like he does, he sort of takes this quest, and the quest takes him out west into Colorado to check out and try to resolve his goddaughter, who is a whitewater rafting instructor, who's gotten over her head and basically has come across a dead body. And while the town believes it's purely an accident, the dead body was in the river, and it's another rider, another whitewater rafter, actually whitewater kayaker. She believes that there's something a lot more to it, and keeps digging her nose into it, and eventually gets tossed in jail herself, just because she's made a complete nuisance of herself to the powers that be in Aspen. And then eventually, when Ty comes out and she tries to convince him that this friend of hers had been killed, the trail leads into the oil country of Colorado, the drought-stricken oil country. And how the book develops really is that it's a modern-day Western, and it's a story of a showdown between farmers and ranchers who are being displaced out of their regular lives due to the high cost of water that oil companies are bidding up for use in the fracking process. So it really sort of pits the David and Goliath story of who Hal takes up of regular small people fighting this company that is really a rogue company and is prepared to do anything they can, including murder, to keep their stronghold on this community. So it's really about the one commodity that's more vital in this drought-stricken area than oil, and that's water.
It sounds like even the range wars of Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett.
Totally. It's a Western. If any of your readers pick it up, it's a great read. I mean, I'm pretty sure he won't be putting it down, but it's very much, I wanted to write a Western, and it is a Western, except the bad guy here isn't the guy that owns the saloon or owns the largest amount of land in town. It's a questionable oil conglomerate, and there's even sort of a shootout at the OK Corral in its own way in this book as well.
The first book during your hook hiatus of the 2011 Eyes Wide Open has been depicted as based on two stories from your own life. A, is that accurate? And B, tell us about it.
Yeah, Eyes Wide Open, when people say to me, what's your favorite book, I have a hard time ever answering the question, because every book I do, I think, has maintained a certain level of integrity. And at the same time, they all have their own little virtues to me, you know, whether in the characters or the stories, et cetera. But this one I took from two personal experiences. One was the death of my nephew by suicide. He jumped off a famous rock formation in Morro Bay, California, all of 21 years old. He was a very troubled bipolar, schizophrenic kid. And at the same time, I wove his tragedy through a storyline that had been in my family for a while, and that's when I was a teenager, I had the pleasure of meeting Charles Manson before he was the nefarious Charles Manson. But my brother lived on the Spawn Ranch with him and brought him up to my dad's house in California to try to raise money for a music project. And my sister and I were around, and we sat through this very sort of weird experience, and that ended up in a bit of an altercation, not so much from him, but from my brother and my father. Which actually he tried to diffuse in a weird way, in a creepy way. And it's always stayed with me, obviously, because of what he turned into and what happened. And so I've sort of woven not Charles Manson, but a cultish, maybe Manson-like figure, that this suicide of a kid, which may in the fact not even be a suicide, that's, weaves through. For those who were put off by Manson, I mean, I don't do a lot of blood and gore, and so there's really nothing of that in there. But there's, I think, a very sort of both creepy and at the same time compelling storyline of this totally mentally ill family that thinks that they've lost their son, but it turns out that the son might have been a little more of a hero than they ever really thought.
It seems to me that you've shown considerable courage over the last 40 years, walking away from a career which had over 50 years' experience. I'm sure you could have stayed in the field in some position. Then leaving the lucrative collaboration and going to uncharted waters as a solo. And finally, abandoning, if only for a while, the character, but the following to try some other things. You probably haven't thought of it that way, but that's how it looks to an outsider.
Well, I guess I'm not risk averse. It's probably that way in my own investment portfolio too. You know what? I think that life, my view of life, is that it's really the goal of life to me is to enrich yourself in experience, and hopefully at the same time, of course, you'd like to raise a family and, you know, bring kids into the world and put them out into the world on a strong footing. But to me, in terms of your own storyline, it's to enrich experience, and you can't do that by staying in the same place. And so I guess I have. Maybe it's a matter of just boredom or complacency, but I've tried very hard when I reach those points to take another step up on the ladder. Yeah. And, you know, to me, the virtue of life, I always say it's sort of like a prize fight. The reward should be cumulative, and they should be greater in the 9th and 10th and 11th and 12th rounds than they are in the first round. And, I don't know that it's been a strategy in terms of how I want to live life, but I think you could probably say it's one of the themes of my life as well. Yeah.
You also maintain an active blog about your writings at www.andrewgrossbooks.com. That's A-N-D-R-E-W-G-R-S-S books.com. Tell us about that, because you seem to have a pretty good interaction with your readers.
Well, I do, but it's mostly on Facebook, you know, to be honest with you. I'm not the biggest blogger. I've done it at times, but I just sort of find it to be an awful lot of work. And the interesting thing is, for someone who for 15 years at least was managing companies and was a very multitasking person, I'm the least multitasking person on the planet these days. I just find it very difficult to break out of the regimen of how I write, and so, you know, when I do other projects, I have to feel that I don't want to do them for cynical reasons, and the cynical reason is, you know, to increase book sales because you interact with people. So I really don't do that much, but I am on Facebook, you know, pretty regularly, and I'm totally into, as you said, my interactions with you know, fans and friends. I think most writers are, because we're all there. You know, so I do that. I don't do Instagram. I'm on Twitter, but I really don't focus on Twitter at all. And a lot of the stuff that's on my website is stuff that's fed through from my Facebook pages and stuff.
What's next for you? Are you staying with Hawk?
Well, on the subject of changing and bringing on new projects, I am doing something entirely different, other than it is a thriller. I've changed publishers at the end, and I've changed genres, and I'm writing a historical. I'm actually in the editing process of it, and it's basically a story about smuggling Jews out of occupied Europe in World War II, from the government's point of view, trying to find one Jew who is a scientist that they believe can literally be the one person who can make the difference on the Manhattan Project in 1944, and he ends up in a Nazi death camp. And the book is really about a Pole, a P-O-L-E, a Polish person who has to go back to the place where his parents were murdered to bring this person out and get in and get them both out. So I think it's kind of a compelling story that brings up a lot of themes, both as a Jewish man, but at the same time, Just as sort of a feeling person, it brings up a lot of survivor guilt. It brings up issues of heroism and personal sacrifice. It's set in Poland in World War II for the most part. So
with Prim, a whole lot in a short time. What else would you like our audience to know about Andrew Gross?
Well, I don't know. You know, what else? You know, I think that I've the most important to me thing to me as a writer is one, two things. One is to it's the process of continuous improvement, not only in your writing style, but also in the what's at stake in your stories and the breadth of your stories. And I'd have to say that if there was one thing I'm proud of as a writer, is that I think that I've maintained a very consistent level of quality and consistency in my books. I don't think that there's a lemon in the group of them. So I write books that not only have a strong, fast-paced storyline, but I try very hard to make them enriching in terms of emotional resonance and affirmation. And so I want them to be emotional experiences as well. So it's kind of what I do.
Well, I've got you in under an hour. I will.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure. I will send you something that interests me relating to the new book, and I'll also send you the URL. You'll have that tonight or tomorrow.
Okay, that's great.
Thank you
very
much.
It's been a pleasure, and glad it all worked out. Thanks, John.
Okay. Good night, Andy.
Thank you. Good night.
A bit of commercial information. My column appears weekly in the Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, critic John Simon, and historian Daniel Price. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon as are Andy's, and I blog at johnmack13.johnmackrants.com. And in the words of the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. Go to my website, www.johnmack13.com, for the URLs of previous shows and for the upcoming shows. And tune in next week for my conversation with Steve Lawrence. Until then, as he used to say in the old neighborhood, see you. Whoa, Sybil.